In this part of Focus 580, we'll be speaking with James Fallows. He is the Atlantic Monthly's national correspondent. He's worked for the magazine now for more than 20 years. He's the author of a number of books, and we'll be talking this morning about his latest, which is titled Free Flight, the subtitle From Airline Hell to a New Age of Travel. Public Affairs is the publisher on the book. It is in part about his own love of flying, not as a passenger, but as a pilot. But it's also, it takes a look at some of what's going on nowadays in the field of general aviation as part of an effort to build planes that are better, are safer, so that in future perhaps more people could fly themselves or use as an option a kind of smaller plane, smaller than a big airliner, that might just be able to operate kind of as an air taxi, to have schedules and would offer schedules that would be more flexible, would get people where they're going sooner, would be more comfortable, and would be competitive in terms of price with major airlines. All of that explored in this book. And as we talk with our guest, James Fallows, questions are certainly welcome. All we ask of people is that they just try to be brief so that we can get in as many folks as possible, but anybody is welcome to call. Here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line. That's good anywhere that you can hear us. So around Illinois, Indiana, any place that signal will travel, you can use the toll-free line and we'll pay for the call. That's 800-222-9455. Again, 333-WILL and toll-free 800-222-WILL. Mr. Fallows, hello.
Nice to talk to you.
Oh, we appreciate you giving us some of your time. So how long have you been flying now?
Oh, a little more than 4 years, so hardly any time at all.
So what was it that, was this something that had always been an interest or something you just thought you'd like to try, or how did you get in?
A combination of the two. One way I knew the difference between me and most of the people I write about in the book is that all of them had always had an intense interest in learning to fly, and I think every single person who founded one of the companies I describe or ran one of the government programs, got a flying license as a teenager. And if you go into their offices, they have, you know, pictures of airplanes on the walls and little models on the desks. I was not in that category. I had, though, always been somewhat interested. When I met a friend who I found out knew how to fly airplanes, I was always sort of perking up when I heard that. And so about 5 years ago, when I had, for the first time in my journalistic career, a steady office job where I had the weekends off, I decided, well, it was time to go out and give this a try.
How many, do you know how many licensed private pilots there are in the United States now?
I do, in fact, know that. It's just under 700,000, something like 675,000, or roughly 0.25% of the population, not a mainstream activity.
Uh-huh. Well, one of the things that you really talk about in the book is the potential for, if we had, if perhaps the public perception about safety improved, and in fact we make the plane safer, and also cost is an issue, because right now to own a plane certainly would be expensive.
Right.
And there are a number of things that might have to happen. But what does anybody's guess about if we could make all those things happen, then how much maybe within, you know, say a generation, we get more young people involved in it, how could the number of private pilots grow?
Well, I think that generation is exactly the right way to think about this, because if you're talking, say, in the next 5 or 10 years, the sorts of, even the most ambitious people think that the main change in the pilot population would be making things relatively easier so that people with some interest like me would find it safe and simple to learn how to fly, and also this air taxi model might evolve. The real change over a generation might be if people who are children now grow up thinking that small airplane travel is both a practical, a safe, and an affordable alternative for them when they're going from place to place. And if that were so, the people at NASA who are doing a lot of the strategizing about this think that piloting could become, you know, if not as widespread as people driving cars, something more like it was in the 1940s and 50s, where it was seen as a more mainstream activity than now.
Mm-hmm. One of the issues that you explore is why it is that it's not seen as a mainstream activity. And in fact, we're now seen to be coming out of a really down period for general aviation. There seem to be a number of answers, none of them perhaps complete, all of them coming together. And, you know, maybe there are some other things that are hard to put your finger on about all getting to this issue. Well, why is it that perhaps more people aren't flying their own airplanes?
Right. And if I had to sort of isolate the big three, they would be these. Number one, since roughly the 1960s, there's been fundamentally no improvement in small airplane technology and in everything else. You know, cars are enormously better than they were in the 1960s. Computers are obviously better. TVs are better. But airplanes have not gotten better until very recently. So there's a kind of technical stagnation that surrounds it. Second, there's the whole question of safety. The reality of small planes is they've been less safe than driving, and certainly less safe than big planes, and the perception is even worse than that, because the perception is that if you get in them, you just die, and we can talk about that later. The third change, I think, is that compared again to since the 1960s, airlines have gotten a lot better. And, I mean, they've gotten better in terms of price, and while they have certain congestion problems now, they are generally more affordable than they were in the 1960s. And so those three things together mean that, say, in the 60s, when salesmen or business people or professionals might find small plane travel a realistic way to get from, you know, Springfield to Wichita or Springfield to Reno or whatever, the alternatives and the technical stagnation have made it seem less attractive.
For a moment, we'll get to this to the story that you tell in the book about the effort to design and build a better small plane. But maybe we need to step back a little and talk about why it is that in commercial air travel we have the system that we have. It's certainly the case. We know that complaints by people who fly in this country are at an all-time high, and anybody who's flown knows exactly why. They know how bad the experience can be, and at the same time, I guess one of the things we have to acknowledge is that one of the big changes between now and several decades ago is that a lot of people fly now. And the reason that they fly is that they can. That is, that you can afford to fly. And so one of the big changes has been, it used to be something that you had to kind of be a rich person to do, that is to, you know, to take a plane on vacation or go visit your relatives or go to Europe, whatever. And now that's just not that way anymore. But the downside is all this other stuff.
Exactly. And I think we can look on airline deregulation as something that worked, but worked both in positive and negative ways. The negative ways were not really foreseen. It was in the late years of Jimmy Carter's administration, now almost 25 years ago, I think it was actually 1978, so 23 years ago, that the airline prices and scheduling were quite thoroughly deregulated. Before that, as many of your listeners are probably too young to remember, there were airline fares were higher than they are now, but there were a whole lot more nonstops. You could go from Little Rock nonstop to Seattle, or Little Rock nonstop to New York. I don't know where you could go nonstop from Springfield, but I'm sure that there were such flights. And with the change, airlines were allowed to compete on price and on schedule. Over those 23 years, the average price per mile per person has gone down about 30%. But the reason airlines have been able to do that is essentially converting themselves into much more ruthlessly efficient economic enterprises. To keep prices low, they have to keep big planes full. And to keep them full, they can't afford to go from Springfield to Seattle. They have to go Springfield to O'Hare, then O'Hare to Atlanta, then Atlanta to Savannah or whatever. That's what they have to do. So it's worked in terms of keeping down fares. It's also avoided what people thought would be the main problem, which is safety. You know, airlines are still extremely safe. The main difficulty has been the more traffic rises, the more it's congested in these very small number of very overwhelmed airports, O'Hare being the main local example. And so the system doesn't scale in technical terms. The more traffic there is, the more congestion and ripple effect happens. So we have low prices, but we have a clotted system.
And the argument you're making in this book is that if we made it possible for more people who wanted to fly themselves, or if we also made it possible for someone to actually have a company that was flying small planes, small jets, that could handle, you know, I don't know how many 5, 10, 15 mm-hmm. passengers that who could actually have the kind of flexibility so people could go when they want, where they want in a more direct sort of way and offer that, be able to offer that service at a competitive price. So your argument is if both of those things could happen, and of course we can talk about what it would take to set up the conditions for that to happen, but your argument is if those things could happen, then we could take some of the burden off of the large commercial airlines and perhaps provide a service that people would be happier with and do it with smaller planes.
Exactly. And I think here's an analogy that I have found useful in thinking about this. When you have a city that's on an island or connected by bridges, that city is always prone to traffic jams. San Francisco, Manhattan, the parts of D.C. that are split by bridges, when you have only a small number of pathways that all the traffic has to cross, if anything goes wrong, everybody's held up. Whereas a city that is not split by water, if one road is blocked, you can go down another number of other roads. You can go up 17th Street and take the other way across. Something similar could be true of air travel. There are roughly 5,000 airports across the country that are suitable for most except the very largest planes. But about two-thirds of all traffic goes through 30 airports because of the current economic structure. So if there were a way to use smaller airports more, it would be more like car travel in a sense of going at your schedule from point to point. Here's one other example. Yesterday, for reasons too strange to explain, I had to go from Duluth, Minnesota to Grand Forks, North Dakota. And there is simply the only way that's about 250, 280 miles. It's a long way to drive. The only way you can go there commercially is going from Duluth to Minneapolis, then Minneapolis to Grand Forks, which takes even longer than driving. And I was able to fly a small plane that distance, and point to point it was a little more than an hour to do that. So making it possible to go from one non-hub city to another non-hub city directly is part of what this system might mean.
Mm. I guess one of the very first questions that comes to my mind is this: that in talking about and reading about this issue of what's wrong with air travel today, some people argue that part of the problem is the air traffic control system, that it just can't handle the volume of traffic. And now, if we're really talking about actually increasing the number of planes that would be in the sky at any one time, this sounds to me like an air traffic control nightmare.
Yes and no. And let me just give two or three different responses. Certainly it is true that the current air traffic system, control system, while run by very competent people for whom I have very high regard, is technologically way backwards. For example, the main communication system that you have for getting clearances and they say climb or turn, it's essentially like CB radios. If any one person is talking, no one else can talk. And there might be 30 pilots listening on one frequency to the same controller, so when any one of them talks, the rest have to be quiet. So, and there are other technical difficulties, and the FAA is now proposing improving that, having more digital data transmission, et cetera. So the system now is backwards. And part of moving towards a system with a much greater number of airports in use would involve sort of reconceiving the air traffic control system. But the reason why I would at least argue it would not be as profound a difficulty as many people might think is that really if you fly around, the only parts of the air now that are crowded at all are the routes into major airports. When I was flying, for example, yesterday between Duluth and Grand Forks, I did not see a single other airplane except in landing pattern at Grand Forks. And once I was flying last month from San Francisco to the Midwest, and hours can pass in which you don't see any other airplane. So the congestion is around the big airports. A reconception of air traffic control using some kind of more computerized system would certainly be necessary, but precisely because the traffic would be dispersed to more places rather than concentrated, the control should actually be easier than it is now.
I should introduce again our guest for this part of Focus. We're speaking with James Fallows. He is national correspondent for The Atlantic Monthly. He's worked for the magazine for more than 20 years now and written about many different subjects. And he's the author of several books that deal with the relationship between the United States and the countries of East Asia. He's written about the American news media. He's written about defense issues. He's a regular commentator for National Public Radio. And the most recent book, the one we're talking about here this morning, is titled Free Flight, and it's published by Public Affairs. Questions are welcome. We have somebody ready to go here to talk with. Others are certainly welcome to call. If you're in Champaign-Urbana, here where we are, 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line, 800-222-9455. The caller here to start us off is in Moments, and that is line number 4. Hello.
Good morning.
Yes.
I've enjoyed Mr. Fallow's work in the Atlantic for a long time now. Glad to speak with him. I'm wondering if what Mr. Fallow's take is on the personal aircraft situation that I've been following in various hobbyist magazines for a long time, Popular Mechanics, Popular Science. Every 5 years, they have a new article, it seems, on these personal little fan jets, and I wonder if he sees that as some kind of reality in our future.
Thanks for your question and your nice comments. I guess the short answer is I don't really know. I've followed some of these same publications and you know, there are people who are designing air cars, and I just was at the Oshkosh Air Show last week in Wisconsin, and you see every sort of oddball contraption, the personal jet pack, personal helicopters and things like that. I guess what struck me is that fertile culture of people tinkering away and building kit airplanes and coming up with inventions, 99% of which are probably never going to reach the market. That's the same culture that is producing a lot of the ideas that actually may have some market effect. And it's intriguing at Oshkosh, where you have, you know, more than 100,000 people coming to look at the displays. You see the sort of seamless transition between the really strange oddball culture and the people who have move from oddballness to actually bringing things to market. So I don't know whether the personal air car will work, but I've come to respect the culture that it represents.
Thank you.
All right. Thanks for the call. To Terre Haute for another caller here. Line 1. Hello. The caller there in Terre Haute, line 1.
Hello.
Oh, yeah.
Kind of a related question is, do you have any idea what percentage of the passengers going through O'Hare, that's not where they originated and that's not their destiny either?
That's a good question. I don't know the answer to it, but my guess would be most, because certainly O'Hare, I believe, it usually rivals Atlanta as the busiest airport in the world, and neither Atlanta nor Chicago is the biggest city in the world. And so, you know, clearly they have that role as transit points. And the fact that as overall air traffic increases, the percentage that goes through these couple of hub airports goes up more and more and more suggests that it's more and more transit passengers than it is people going to Chicago.
Right, yeah. Well, it's a good idea and very interesting program. I'll hang up and listen.
Very
great.
Good.
Thank
well,
you.
Thanks for the call. And again, people who are listening, if you have questions, comments, you're certainly welcome to call 333-9455 here in Champaign-Urbana, toll-free 800-222-9455. One of the things that you write about in the book is the fact that now for many years, the small plane market has been dominated by just a handful of companies. And if you look at the planes themselves, with the exception of some changes in the instrumentation, that they really have changed very little. About the only thing that really has changed is that over the years they've just become more and more expensive. So they're just asking more and more money for a plane that is essentially the same. How is it that is the reality of the small plane business?
The clearest way to establish that reality is to dig out some movie from the 1960s that had a lot of airplanes in it. My two favorite examples are It's a Mad, 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 Mad World, where there's a lot of airplane chase scenes, and The Thomas Crown Affair with Steve McQueen. I think it was Ally McGraw with him, and I think Steve McQueen, and he was doing a lot of flying outside Boston. And you realize that most things in this movie look dated, but the airplanes don't. The airplanes are just the same as the ones you would see at some local airport in the year 2001. And I think there are Rashomon-like different explanations of how this came to be, why it was that airplanes, there were 18,000 small airplanes sold in 1978 and only about 1,000 sold per year a couple of years ago. The traditional
airplane manufacturers like Cessna and Piper and Beech say that it was mainly a legal problem. They were being sued for tort liability when people crashed, and so they just decided to phase out of this business. The rationale that I think is more insightful or more impressive is that starting in the late 70s, these companies realized that the money was in corporate jets. So they've actually been quite innovative when it comes to new corporate jets. The Cessna Citation, the Gulfstreams, the Challengers, these things are quite advanced. And so they've addressed the top end of the market where things are, you know, the planes cost $8 or $10 million, and decided just to let this lower end stagnate. And so it was a kind of vicious cycle. The planes became older, more expensive, less attractive, less effective. Fewer people were interested in them, and the market drove itself down. It was sort of like the bad old days of Detroit in the 70s. But different people have different explanations. Clearly, it was a downward spiral in small plane activity in the last 25 years.
Well, it was Faye Dunaway, by the way.
Uh-huh.
It made quite an impression on me when I was a young man when I saw it. Well, then in order to offer a new product, something that would be a much better plane in a lot of ways, you chart the experiences of a couple of guys who started a company. Cirrus is called, and it's located in Duluth?
It's in Duluth, where I am at this moment.
Where they have their plant. And these were a couple of Midwestern guys, a couple of young guys who are a part of this community that you talk about, these people that from the time that they were kids, they loved planes, they wanted to fly, the kind of people who actually could build a kit plane and put it together and make it work. What was it that got them into this idea that maybe they could produce a better small plane?
Well, you know, they come from a very interesting Midwestern/American tinkerer can-do background. One of their uncles started on his own a boat company and built a lot of fiberglass boats, and their parents started from basically nothing, a chain of nursing homes, which they built a sort of high-end nursing homes, and they were able to sell them when these Klapmeyer brothers were in their early 20s, which actually provided the initial capital for their airplane company. But as far as I can tell, the only thing these brothers, Dale and Alan Klapmeyer, ever wanted to do was to make an airplane company. And so they went to college, and as soon as the younger one had finished college, they started this kit plane company in a barn in Baraboo, Wisconsin. And they discovered that they had some innovative kit planes that they got a lot of press for, but they realized that the market of people who had, you know, more than $100,000 to spend on the parts for a kit plane, but also had a couple thousand hours of spare time to build them, that was a small market. The number of people had both the money and the time. So they said, let's build a so-called certified airplane, one that people don't have to build, but it's a normal factory-built airplane. And for the last 10 years, they have, with the same zeal you find in the computer pioneers of 25 years ago, they've put together a company now of 500 employees with 800 orders for their plane, saying, we just want to make a new plane that will change the way people think about small airplanes.
And this is the SR-20?
Yes, the Cirrus SR-20, and now its big brother, the Cirrus SR-22, which they hope are the first in a long line of planes they will build.
Mm. Well, for the novice, the person who really knows nothing about airplanes, would look at one of these planes. What would make this plane different from the Piper or the Beechcraft or the planes that are those same planes that we see in the, you know, movies from the 1960s?
Well, there are a couple of things, and I'll build up to the one that is most dramatic to most passengers. One is, if you look inside them, they're nice inside. The typical rental Cessna or Beechcraft that you'll find at a small airport was built more than 25 years ago, and it really looks it. It looks like a 25-year-old Montego or Gremlin inside. The seats are all, it looks like a beat-up vehicle. The Cirrus, by contrast, is modeled on nice modern automobiles of like a German or Japanese or American luxury car. So it seems nice inside. If you sit in the end, it's very, very spacious. If you sit in the pilot seat, you see there are fewer dials than a normal airplane and more big screens, big moving maps showing where you're going, like in modern jets. If you looked at the performance charts, you'd find that it looked more streamlined and went much faster on the same amount of gas or power than previous planes. But the main thing that passengers would notice if they read about it is the plane has a parachute for the entire airplane. Mm-hmm. So that if something happens, there's a lever you can pull, and this parachute comes out of the back, and the whole airplane comes to Earth in a three-point level descent. And so for John Kennedy-type situations, it gives people a way out.
Yeah. So if we look at those conditions that you'd have to satisfy to make general aviation maybe more acceptable and more accessible to people, they are those things that comfort certainly is important, but a plane that's easy to fly and a plane that's safe, these guys you think have satisfied at least those conditions pretty well?
I think they have started down the market for people who have any interest in flying a plane themselves. And the reason I spent so much time on them in the book is that they were the first people actually to have brought something new to market. And in that rough way, I would compare them to the Macintosh designers of the computer world. They said, there's a way to make these things simpler. There's a way to make them more attractive. There's a way to make them more crash-worthy. And so their dream would be if they could attract more people into actual flying, the current 0.25% pilots might grow by some factor over time. So they represent the way of making flying your own plane more attractive than it has been for 30 or 40 years.
So if you want to go out and buy an SR-20 new, what would it cost you?
It would cost you now, I think, $179,000, which is a lot of money.
That's still a lot of money.
And the argument, the rationale they make is that airplanes typically, unlike cars, they become more valuable as time goes on. So usually you can count on them having 20 or 25 years of usable life, and so you can finance them like a house. So they're presenting this as an alternative to the vacation cottage, an alternative to the giant RV, something you can finance over 20 years. They also realize that to have any kind of mass appeal, that the price has to go down significantly, perhaps by a half, but certainly by 40% as volume manufacturing comes in.
And how many of these planes have they? They've now been producing planes for a couple of years,
maybe? They delivered their first plane almost exactly 2 years ago, and then they were producing first one a month, then one a week. They're now doing one a day. Their plan is to be at two a day, I think, by the beginning of next year. They have delivered 200. They have orders for 800 plus.
Hmm. And have they been, even you'd have to say on one level, that's certainly successful. Would they say that they've been successful, or in terms of just hard-nosed numbers, financially, have they been successful?
They have not yet made a profit, but they are about to close a major financing deal, which will allow them to get to the two or three a day production level. The whole drama of their life in the last two or three years has been raising money. It's not been so much making the airplanes or selling airplanes, but getting capital to expand the production lines. And they to the best of my knowledge, they will very soon announce a quite significant financing deal, which will allow them to get over the hump. And when they're producing planes, they claim that when they're producing an average of more than one a day, of more than like 1.5 or something per day, then they will be profitable at that level. So that's their claim.
We have someone else to talk with. This is a caller in Chicago, and it's line number 4. Hello.
Yeah, hi.
Yeah.
I have one statement and then a question. So the statement is about regular airlines. I find that I don't understand how people can say that flying these days is better than it was in the old days. To me, it's more expensive. I usually used to do my flying between Chicago and New York. Unless you reserve a seat some weeks in advance, a plane ride is extremely expensive, whereas years ago, you could call up 15 minutes, make up your mind a few hours beforehand, and a return trip ticket would be maybe $50-$60. Now it's somewhere in the range of these days, well, with the price of gasoline gone up, the price of tickets went up about 25%, the cheapest round trip from Chicago to New York now somewhere around $125. That's only if you reserve in advance 2-3 weeks or more. Otherwise, they have you by the throat, and it runs into hundreds of dollars. With respect to general aviation, have you considered what the cost would be as far as environmental concerns are? These things burn a lot of carbon fuel and all that sort of stuff.
Those are two good questions. And on the first point, I exactly agree with you that what's changed in airline pricing is the cost of flexibility is much higher than it used to be. In the pre-deregulation days, if you bought a ticket an hour ahead of time, a month ahead of time, it was the same. Now, if you buy it an hour ahead of time, it can cost literally 10 times as much as if you buy it in the cheapest way, you know, many months ahead of time. There have been extensive studies, all of which have come to the same conclusion, that the average fare these days, when you take into account all the discounts that are available, the average fare is indeed lower than it used to be. The difficulty is that to get that lowest fare, you need to be much more constrained and much less flexible. And so to the extent travel is supposed to make us more flexible, and that's what the rest of our modern life is about, flexibility, the airlines are not serving us well. You have to really pay to change your plan. So that's part of I was not arguing the airlines are at all perfect these days. I think they are extremely safe, and I think the average fare has gone down, but the price for flexibility is high. The environmental consequences of general aviation are quite interesting and are also something that NASA is studying extensively. There is one clear one way in which they are inferior to a 747, which is since the gasoline efficiency per person is by definition better with a bigger vehicle than a smaller one. A 747 carrying 400 people will have fewer CO2 emissions per person and use less gas per person than a small plane carrying 5 or 6 people. The same is true in land transport. You know, a bus is always more efficient than a car. A railroad train is more efficient than a bus. But we recognize for land transportation we need some mixture of those things, that there are some trade-offs, the flexibility that the cars give. And so And there also is a lot of wasted environmental effect of the big airline system, of all the sort of gas and congestion wasted as you try to get to these few big choke points. There's a way in which many people at NASA argue that small planes could actually be an environmental plus, which is if they allow people to live and work more remotely without paving all the distance between two places, then that can be a nice thing. With an airplane, you can get to some remote area without building a strip mall all the way there, as you have to do for cars. One other environmental point, everyone involved here recognizes that noise pollution needs to be driven down quite rapidly if small planes are to be acceptable. And one of the most interesting new innovations is a small jet engine that's much quieter than its predecessors. So that's my omnibus reply.
You don't have any numbers or anything to compare.
Of which sort?
Well, the small planes as against, say, an automobile or, fuel.
I can give you this now. One of these Cirrus SR20s we've been talking about gets about 20 or 21 miles per gallon and can carry up to 4 people. So that's comparable with many automobiles now.
Uh-huh.
If I were comparing the trip I made yesterday from Duluth to Grand Forks in a car versus a plane, it was no worse environmental impact for me to go there by airplane than it would have been to drive.
Okay, thank you.
All right. We have about 10 minutes left in this part of Focus 580. Our guest is James Fallows, national correspondent for The Atlantic Monthly, and we are talking about his book, Free Flight. It's just out now, published by Public Affairs, in bookstores now, as are his others, I'm sure. Questions welcome, 333-WILL, toll-free 800-222-WILL. We've talked a little bit here about the Cirrus Design Corporation of Duluth and having produced what a lot of people think is a much better, for a variety of reasons, small plane. And it is a prop plane. It has propellers, and there's still yet another need here. A lot of people feel that there is a need for a small plane that would be able to fly faster, that would have a greater range, and perhaps this is the one that we would be thinking of as being a candidate for somebody who might want to operate an air taxi service. And here also in the book, you talk about a company in New Mexico that is working on designing and building a plane. It's not on the market yet. It's called the Eclipse. It is a jet plane. Will seat, five?
Yes.
People?
Up to five plus a pilot.
Mm. And this might be the kind of plane that could fill that niche. Talk a little bit with us about the Eclipse.
The background factor here is that the main variable in making airplanes safe and comfortable and fast is the kind of engine they have. And jet engines, turbine engines, when they came to airline travel starting in the early 1960s, made a huge difference in comfort and safety and speed. They're safer partly because they're so much more reliable. It's just a turning rotor, and that fails far less frequently than does an internal combustion engine. They're safer also because they can take planes above or around most difficult weather situations, and so they're just better. And the breakthrough that the Eclipse Aviation Company is trying to bring to market is based on a radically small, radically light, radically less expensive jet turbine engine invented by a company called Williams International. This was first used for cruise missiles, for military cruise missiles, and it was the engine that was small enough to make cruise missiles possible. Sam Williams, who's now in his early 80s, is the inventor who came up with this cruise missile engine, and on the strength of two of these engines, which together they weigh about 80 pounds apiece and they produce more than 700 pounds of thrust, with two of those engines, Eclipse is proposing and will test fly early next year a plane. It would be essentially a small corporate jet that cost about one-tenth as much as existing corporate jets. And the idea is that with something that costs so much less than a Gulfstream and a Citation and a Challenger, you could equip these air taxi operators so that if you want to be picked up in Champaign-Urbana and taken direct to Casper, Wyoming, they could pick you up at a time of your convenience and take you straight there without going through either Denver or O'Hare, and for a fare like today's full fare coach fare.
Mm-hmm. And is the thought that this would be something that would primarily, if such a service existed, it would be primarily of interest to and used by business travelers?
I think the idea is that with other technical innovations, including airline travel itself when it first came out, it would necessarily start out at the upper end of the economic ladder, but then expand with volume. The comparison, again, is the typical nice corporate jet costs roughly $10 million. And so it's only a very rich person or a big corporation that can afford that. If you have a plane like the Eclipse, they say they'll bring to market for $837,000, still only a rich person would buy that. But a company could buy that, for costs about one-tenth of those of corporate jets. And the pricing model is, if you had a single person in this plane that could carry five people, the fare would then clearly be more than it would be to take a normal airliner. But if you had two people, the fare for each of them would be comparable to a full fare coach now, and it could be at their schedule and with convenience. And if you had three or four or five people or a family, then the cost would be the same for the airplane. So the cost per person would be much less than it is commercially. So they have plans for doing this in increasing volume, which would bring down costs, and having the same sort of spread, that it would not ever compete with the cheapest discount fares for the airlines, but it could compete sort of with the most expensive 50% of the airline traffic.
Hmm. It's interesting in here talking about here at least two efforts, and there may indeed be some other people who are trying to look at the field of general aviation and build planes that are less expensive, that are safer, and so forth. It seems, though, when you're looking at the people who are building the big planes, it's definitely going in the other direction. Airbus and I think also Boeing, what they're looking at is building even commercial airlines that are even bigger, that would just be stunningly enormous, because they somehow think that the key is being able to carry more people, have a bigger plane.
Well, interestingly, Airbus certainly is going in exactly the direction you say. They have some plane going to be named the Behemoth or the Gargantua or whatever. I think it will carry 600 people. But Boeing has shied away from that.
Hmm.
Boeing's alternative model is a plane that will be faster, that if it were like anything, it'd be more like the Concorde than like the Gargantua. It would have a sort of advanced flying wing type shape. Now, I don't know whether they actually will build this advanced flying wing, but Boeing has been explicit in saying that for most markets, the 747 is about as big as an airplane needs to be. The number of markets where you can efficiently carry 600 people time and again and again and again, they're saying is not that large.
Hmm. I guess they're in Britain, they're thinking about carrying enormous loads of English people to Mallorca all at one time, or something like that.
Yeah, we'll see how the Mallorcans feel about this when the Gargantuas start landing.
Well, let's talk with someone here in Urbana. Line number one. Hello.
Yeah, two quick things. One is recently I saw a picture in the paper of two small airplanes, private airplanes, locked together in Italy, and they apparently spiraled down, locked together to the ground, and the pilots survived.
Mm.
And number one, I was just curious if you knew anything more, any details about that.
On that particular episode, I don't know about that. I know some similar things where there was something in Florida, I think, last year where a plane was descending on top of another one when they were both about to land, and the pilot on the bottom sort of flew them both down to a safe landing. Quite impressive.
Yeah, well, this picture they had in the paper showed the nose of both airplanes in the ground. So I was really curious about the details of that. But anyway, the other question I was going to ask you have they done anything in the way of making small planes safer in storms, or do they? Is it pretty much like it used to be, that they still have to fly around them?
It still is the case that thunderstorms are the enemy, even for airliners. Now, if you listen to air traffic control when you're flying, especially on United, you hear the airliners all the time talking about deviating around thunderstorms, because that's the one thing that even an airliner cannot go over. So I think that thunderstorms are probably, for any foreseeable innovation in small planes, that's something that people will want to avoid rather than withstand. But there are a lot of other weather safety innovations taking place, of ways to reduce the icing danger, ways to have much better information on where the storms actually are, ways to get around hail, et cetera, et cetera. But still, a thunderstorm is something you want to avoid. I speak as somebody who's unfortunately been in one or two in a plane, but I would rather not do it anymore. Thanks.
Okay. Other questions? Welcome if somebody calls real quick. Got about 5 minutes. 333-WILL. Toll free 800-222-WILL. When you look at crashes, small plane crashes, and when we're talking about not experimental craft but certified planes, those designs where the federal government had said, yes, this is okay, it's a safe plane, you can feel okay about flying it. When you take a look at crashes and you take a look at why, what happened, what are the leading causes?
The overwhelming cause is weather in the broadest sense, including planes that get into ice-filled storms and lose their ability to fly because the shape of the wing changes. There's a very, very large category, probably the largest single category, of pilots who are not trained for instrument flight, who get into circumstances where they can no longer see outside. This is, of course, familiar with the John Kennedy scenario. And as everybody who's been through this training knows, but the general public may not believe, if you can't see the ground or see the horizon, you cannot tell up from down in an airplane unless you know how to use the instruments. And that was the John Kennedy problem. Weather, losing orientation, running out of gas, maneuvering close to the ground, these sorts of theoretically predictable and controllable factors account for most small plane crashes, as opposed to mechanical failure or other things which seem more like act of God. That's why small plane pilots both study crash reports so extensively and feel that they can keep flying, because they think that the risk factors are more predictable than they are for large planes.
Mm-hmm. Then I guess we come to the question, is it possible to design a plane that's more forgiving or more helpful, or will try to get pilots out of problems that they got themselves into?
Yes, and you've put it more crisply than I have. Yes, with better weather information, you can see where the problems are. There's a kind of new kind of wing, a so-called wing cuff on the Cirrus plane, which makes it much harder to stall the airplane, which is a way that the pilots often get in trouble if they don't know what they're doing. They can suddenly lose the ability to fly. It's harder to do that with the Cirrus. The parachute is an extra of important act of forgiveness. In the last 30 years, automobiles have become much more crash-worthy in their internal structure, and the new airplanes are also much more crash-worthy, that if you do end up hitting the ground, they're meant to protect the occupants much more than was the case 20 years ago. And there's a new thing that NASA is pushing, a so-called highway-in-the-sky display, where essentially flying the plane is like doing a video game. You're watching a screen, there's a number of boxes you're supposed to fly the plane through, and if you do that, you get to where you're supposed to go. So lots of people on sort of parallel fronts are working to find ways to make this a more forgiving activity.
Yeah, I think it's interesting that some of the reaction to the parachute that you talk about in the book, for me as a layperson, this sounds like a swell idea, but apparently some pilots weren't real sure. They thought, in fact, that what it would do, it would make you feel too comfortable and might indeed lead people to do things that they wouldn't otherwise do because they would say, well, you know, heck, no matter what happens, we got this parachute, so we'll be okay.
Yeah. There is a real sort of macho crustiness saying, well, you know, if you were a good enough pilot, you'd never need that, or I'd never use that sissy thing. And the answer that the Cirrus company gives to that, which I think is a good one, is that this parachute is essentially like military ejection seats. Now, military pilots are very skillful. They are very tough guys, but they recognize their circumstances where they need to save their lives. By the same analogy, their circumstances may arise, and it's nice to have one more alternative.
Yeah. Well, I appreciate you very much giving us some of your time and talking with the book, and we want to say thanks very much.
Thank you for your excellent questions. I appreciate it.
Our guest, James Fallows. He is national correspondent for The Atlantic Monthly. And the book, if you would like to take a look at it, it's just out now recently. It's titled Free Flight, the subtitle From Airline Hell to a New Age of Travel, published by Public Affairs.